Let's Talk Books. We do it each Tuesday around this time, and I'm joined by novelist, reviewer and writer-in-residence at Victoria University, Catherine Robertson. Hi, Catherine.
Hello.
How do you ever find any time to read?
Well, I think actually once you start, when I started doing reviews about 7 years ago for The Listener, I had to retrain myself to read fast.
Yeah.
You know, because I was supposed to read something like 4 books in a month, in 4 weeks. So it was huge. And so I kind of not really got out of the habit of that. And also now that Jane and I are setting up the bookshop, we've been reading all the advanced copies and the reader's copies, so we can share that and put little reviews online together. So
great.
I'm cranking through the reading.
Do you know, when I was little, my dad, when I was reading a book, he'd always say, make sure you've got enough light. Go sit under the light. Sit next to the window. Just get enough light. And then
my
found myself saying
like
exactly the same thing to my 9-year-old the other day, and I'm like, oh, I'm turning into my dad. Hazel, turn the light up. Sit under the light. Yeah.
I'm so thrilled that when my children were reading, I was just going, you can read any way you like. That's great.
Yeah. Hey, you've read one by Kurt Anderson, and I'm quite keen on this guy. I've interviewed him, and I read his book, Turn of the Century. He's quite a funny writer, as I recall.
He's funny in a very acerbic way. I mean, this is not a book that you go into with any illusions about what the author feels about things.
Mm-hmm.
He's incredibly pointed, very funny, rather rude in a sardonic sense. So, yeah, he's rather mordant. I like his style very much.
It's called Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire.
Yes. And he, I think the back cover says it all. It says, welcome to the land of the free and the home of the fake.
Hmm.
And he says, their freedom to invent and believe whatever the hell you like has been a defining right in the United States ever since the Pilgrim Fathers first landed to practice their rogue beliefs. So he wrote it, obviously, just after, it was published in 2017, so he wrote it after Trump took power, to really kind of understand what was going on in this sort of post-truth world. And, I mean, the amount of sort of scholarship and research in here is huge, because he does actually romp you through 500 years, starts with the Pilgrim's Landing and sort of ends up in modern day. And to be fair, I've actually only got as far as the 1960s. So I have to keep stopping every so often because it's a bit traumatic, really, reading about it.
Really?
But it is fascinating. And, I mean, his whole premise is that when America was founded, the sort of the cultural impetus was about remaking yourself. So the Pilgrims came to remake their religion. And so the people that landed could forget where they came from. They could forget any ties to their cultures and beliefs that they had. And they could reinvent themselves in whatever way. And, and he talks a lot about that, if, you know, the sort of the idea that if you feel it, it must be true. So, you know, the sort of like, if I feel it in my gut, then it must be it. I mean, he quotes
which Trump has become famous for, the sort of the fake news era, but he really, you know, he takes it back. I mean, he talks about that sort of attitude within the George W. Bush administration.
Yeah.
And partly traces it back to the 1960s and the kind of the eroding of respect in the establishment.
Well, that's right. I mean, and that's the really fascinating thing that he's pointed out about the 60s, is that when it was supposedly all about freedom and going your own way and things like that, what it was about individualism and effectively distrusting authority. And he actually puts the genesis of the distrust of authority and governmental structures back to the 1960s. So while they might have said, be free and break out of the shackles that society, the narrow boxes that society puts you in, which can be a good thing, everybody sort of, you know, they also sort of gave them the freedom to say, well, I want to be this or I want to be that, or, you know, I'm going to start this religion called Scientology, etc., things like that.
I wonder if he sees postmodernism as part of the problem.
I do not feel qualified to discuss postmodernism on the radio.
but it's that idea, as you allude to, that there is not just one truth, that everyone's personal experience is their own truth, and it's very respectable sort of, you know, academic school of thought, but it is slightly tied in with these other sorts of ideas, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, you know, this book is very much about proving his point. So, you know, if you wanted to critique it properly, you'd have to go back and investigate all the scholarship and all the research that he's done, because he's very much picking and choosing the bits that he wants to put in there. But I think, you know, the I think the point is there, you know, the point is made. I mean, he was sort of taking in the introduction to it. He talks about the sort of statistics of what Americans believe. And he says if you take, and they're all from different, you know, surveys, but 2/3 of Americans believe that angels and demons are active in the world. More than a third of us believe not only that global warming is no big deal, but it's a hoax perpetrated by a conspiracy of scientists, governments and journalists. A third believe that the government has, in league with the pharmaceutical industry, hidden evidence of natural cancer cures and that extraterrestrials have recently visited and now reside on Earth. You know, and these are from actual surveys of what Americans believe. And he sort of suggests that they are the epicentre of what he calls fantasy land. And I think he has got a point because, you know, a lot of the conspiracy theories, if not all of the conspiracy theories, they have generated from the States. You know, the mole children, that's just one I picked out, which I find instantly fascinating. And it sort of, I think also, like, you know, what surprised me was that I realised a lot of religions, like the Baptist religion, and I knew about Mormonism and Scientology, etc., if you can possibly call that a religion. But, you know, things like the Baptists started there, all the Pentecostal evangelistic churches started there. And they started because people wanted more of a emotional experience when they went to church. And so he goes into that sort of, you know, the beginning of the speaking in tongues, etc. And I mean, I must say, it's just, it's, I mean, as I say, he does pull out sort of like the choicest bits, but I also found out that snake oil was actually a thing. Somebody went and sold something that they called snake oil. It wasn't just a synonym for everything that was, you know, just bundled in a bottle and sold to you. Amazing.
He makes a, he's very good at making an argument, and I'd also like to point readers to an essay he wrote for Vanity Fair in 2011, where he makes the case that popular style has stopped, that we've stopped creating anything new and we've just started consuming the past instead of creating the new, that everyone looks the same and that we look kind of the same as we did 20 years ago, and this kind of fashion has died. It's a great essay for anyone who's interested.
That's interesting because, yeah, and he talks a lot about that. I mean, of course, you know, the United States is the home of show business as well. And you, I mean, he talks about sort of, you know, mix epic individualism with extreme religion, mix show business with everything else, let all that steep and simmer for a few centuries, run it through the anything goes 1960s and the internet age. And the result is America we inhabit today, where reality and fantasy are weirdly and dangerously blurred and commingled. That kind of sums up the whole book. But yeah, it's fascinating.
Great at kind of opening his arms up and pulling it all in and creating a coherent narrative. Great. It's called Fantasyland, How America Went Haywire. And I have just recalled that I interviewed this author about this book a couple of years ago. So if you're really interested, you go listen to that on the RNZ website.
Yeah, I must point out that this was lent to me by Jeff Kennedy from Prefab Cafe and the Acme Company. And he has a pile of them under his counter. Ah. Should you want to try and buy one off Jeff?
It's pretty near to your new site, is it?
It is indeed. Yeah. He said he's not going to sell books when we set up, but that's fine.
Okay, and you've also been reading something completely different.
I know, again, lent to me by Caroline. We were talking about it in the pub, as you do, and she said, have you ever read The Story of a New Zealand River? And I knew of it as the book that most people think that Piano was based on, but I had to say no, and she said, I'll lend it to you. And I was thinking, oh, you know, that it would be a bit grim, because the piano's a bit grim, and it would be a bit sort of slow-moving, etc. And what I got was this absolutely cracking read. And it's not, as I say, no spoilers, but no, it is a spoiler alert. It is not the story of a New Zealand river. I don't even know. I think they go in a boat up a river, but the river does not feature in it at all, really. But, you know, I sort of thought that she couldn't, because it's quite raunchy. So I figure she couldn't call it Getting Some by the Gumfields. That was not, considering it was published in 1920, it probably wasn't fit for the time.
That's a great title, though.
I know. She wrote quite a number of books. I mean, this is the one that sort of people value the most, I suppose, but she had terrible titles. They called things like The Passionate Puritan, Eleanor Dare, The Besieging City, and Pins and Pinnacles. And so, I mean, I wouldn't sort of, you know, I wouldn't judge anybody for not actually picking them up, judging by those titles. But I really loved this. And I was thinking, I got to read, you know, one of the only New Zealand books I think I got to study at school, which is a shame enough in itself, was John Mulgan's Man Alone, which is grim. And it is sort of like, you know, getting through it. And it's you know, as the title would suggest, entirely about a bloke. And whereas this one is, you know, Jane Mander was a feminist writer. She started off as a journalist, working for her dad. Her dad actually bought the Northern Advocate in Whangarei. And and she moved in 1912 to New York City, and she went to study journalism at Columbia. And then she became there involved in the women's suffrage movement. So her women, it is all about female independence. And she usually has a very independent character, apparently in the other books as well. In this one, it is the daughter of the young woman, Alice, who is basically supposedly a widow and with one daughter, and she ends up marrying a guy who is sort of setting up a kauri mill in off the Kaipara Harbour. And he, you know, he's kind of the Sam Neill character in the piano. Only in this book, he's better than that. Her men and her, you know, female characters are very rounded. Her writing is, you know, it's a bit purple at times, but it is good enough for it to be a highly enjoyable read. And I was really taken with the way that she talks about, you know, she's very frank about sex. She's very frank about male and female relationships in their entirety, you know, and what sort of forms attractions. She's very good with the daughter grows up. It's sort of like a three-part novel. And in the beginning, the daughter, Asia, is 11, and in the end, she's in her 20s. And, no, I can't spoil that, but she goes and does something quite shocking for the time. And so it is, you know, and there are older female characters. She kind of does the whole gamut. There's an older woman called Mrs. Brayton, as well as Alice Rowland, who's the one who struggles the most with the societal expectations. And she sort of, through the novel, works out that she's just doing whatever she's been told she should do. And what, you know, she's never, ever really thought for herself or thought about what she wants.
Yeah, pretty strong stuff in 1920, eh?
Very strong stuff. Yeah. I mean, and a lot of the sort of, you know, the discussions they have are really kind of what I felt were quite modern sort of self-help discussions. They were really quite liberated, I thought. And I've certainly read worse stuff in proper modern self-help books.
Great. Hey, before you go, how's the launch date for the bookshop Good Books going?
6th of October. It's a Tuesday because a couple of our staff don't work on the Monday, and basically we need all the days we can get setting it up. So
great.
6th of October, 16 Jesse Street.
We'll be thinking of you, and send me a note and I'll let people know.
Oh, you can come down. We'll have a party.
Oh, yeah, any excuse.
Yeah.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thank you.
Catherine Robertson, talking books.